Good evening. Welcome. We're very glad that you could join us for this opportunity to talk about the current financial crisis. I want to introduce my colleagues, tell you a little bit about why we're here, suggest some themes that you might want to organize your thinking around as we explore this issue, and make a few other brief announcements. We know that many of you may need to slip out a little bit early for other classes. We also know that at 7 o'clock there's a memorial service for the late English professor Nadine Chapman in the chapel. We certainly understand if people want to leave for those things. I encourage you to feel free to do so. I'm Walter Hutchins. I'm the chair of the Department of Economics and Business in the School of Global Commerce and Management at Whitworth. I realize most of you know us, but there may be a few guests, so I'll introduce my distinguished colleagues. Dr. Richard Schatz has a PhD from the University of Hawaii and had a distinguished career as a developmental economist with the Asian Development Bank, focused mainly on South Asia and Southeast Asia. He's been teaching economics at Whitworth for 20 years. Professor Douglas Lahr has an undergraduate degree in finance from the University of Wisconsin, a master's degree in international business from Regis University, and is currently completing a doctorate at Anderson, and as many of you know, teaches in the areas of finance and investing here at Whitworth. I'm Walter Hutchins. I teach courses on business law and international business, as well as some things in our MBA program, and we're delighted that you could join us. The origin of this was that the three of us, as we would walk through the hallways for the last few weeks, would just go into each other's office and go, "Wow, did you see what just happened? What did that mean? What did you think about that? What's going to be the next shoe to drop?" And it occurred to us, given the gravity of the situation, and in fact the apparently snowballing sense of urgency about it, that it would be a good idea for us to take our hallway discussions to a more public forum and also invite you to participate in those. When we started thinking about doing that, one of the concerns I had, maybe as the junior guy on the faculty, was, but I don't really understand what's going on exactly. I don't feel really confident about holding forth and describing what's happening, much less opining about what should be happening. And yesterday, as I watched the rebroadcast of the 5.5-hour Senate Banking Committee hearing on this topic, in which the Treasury Department head, Henry Paulson, the SEC head, Harvey Cox, the head of the Federal Reserve, Ben Bernanke, and the director of the department of the government that's now running the mortgage business in the country, were trying to sell their request for a $700 billion blank check to the Congress, I realized it's okay, because they don't really either fully understand what's going on and have a handle on this. So we want to sort of frame that in that way, that this is a discussion, not a three sages on a stage making oracular commentary on the way it is and should be. So we look forward to your questions and interrogations about it. We thought it would just be a good public service for us to try to provide some information about what's happening, because a lot of it is opaque, not something that we normally encounter in our daily lives as consumers and certainly as students, and also offer some analysis. I thought I'd start by just telling you how, as many of you know from taking my classes, one of the things I do is I assign, in addition to the textbook and the normal reading assignments, that you keep up with current events. So I ask students to read a national newspaper and be ready for pop quizzes on current events. And this semester has been interesting because it could have unfolded in a sort of conventional way. You know, who's making a speech at the United Nations today? What did McCain or Obama say about lipstick today, or something along those lines? But the questions have been things more like, how many billions of dollars did Merrill Lynch write down and before its CEO, Stan O'Neill, resigned last spring? Why is it that Bear Stearns had a shotgun marriage to J.P. Morgan? And then who are Fannie and Freddie? And how is it that the United States government is now owning 80% of their stock after loaning them an enormous amount of money? And who cares who Fannie and Freddie are? And then the $85 billion credit facility to AIG, the largest insurance company on earth. Then the bankruptcy of Lehman Brothers and the sale after Chapter 11 reorganization to part of its business to Barclays. And now, this week, these urgent hearings before Congress, yesterday on the Senate side and today on the House side, saying if we don't pass this enormous revolutionary authority and give it to the Secretary of the Treasury to work with the Fed, that we will have a financial Armageddon. This has, you know, been a special series of events. I'm going to invite each of my colleagues to say a few things, but I thought I would offer to you some ideas about how to track this discussion, because just like the situation, it will be, I imagine, somewhat fluid, and there may be some jargon and unusual concepts or acronyms to keep up with. So I would suggest four questions that you might try to follow. One is, what is happening? Why does it matter? Why does it matter at a national level? Why does it matter internationally? What does it matter for Whitworth or for you? Implicit in this is the need for some background, a certain degree of vocabulary about what a credit default swap is, what's a secondary mortgage market, and how are Fannie and Freddie involved in this. Also, a certain sense of the chronology, I think, would be helpful to sort of construct a timeline as I began to sketch for you. And then some of these concepts about the way these financial markets work. Besides just getting a handle on what's happening and why it matters, I think all of us will ask, how did we get here? There have been a series of statements by financial market regulators and participants saying everything's fine, don't worry about it, nothing to see here, move along. And now we are, you know, told that barring some tremendous intervention, we could be in real trouble. So how do we get here? And implicit in that, I think, is who's to blame? Who should we want to punish for this? And that'll be a thing about which I imagine each of us will have some views. A third question is, what's being done about the problem? What's already been done and what is proposed? What are the options to the policy alternatives or proposals that have been put forward? What do we think about those? Do the steps that the government has taken or proposes to take seem correct to us? And fourth, I think beyond the sort of sense of urgency about a freeze-up in the financial system and its potentially dramatic implications, everybody's going to want to step back from this and say, what does it mean in a longer-term sense? What sort of regulatory policy or behavioral changes are called for because of this once we get out of a freezing of the credit system? So those are some thoughts I would offer you as ways to follow the discussion and frame your own notes about it. With that.
If you don't mind, I'm going to stand up. I'm uncomfortable sitting there. Hi, I'm Richard Schatz. You know, this is a historic event tonight. This is by far, I'm sure, the most students ever accumulated in one room to talk about economics and finance. And I'm absolutely sure that you're here out of your pure intellectual interest in the topic. And those little incentives that my colleagues gave to give you here, I'm sure that wasn't a big factor. Well, thanks for coming. It also occurs to me that this is not as big a crowd as we get at a basketball game or a football game, but certainly more than we get at a swim meet or a softball game. So, hey, economics is happening. Well, I'm just going to talk for a couple of minutes. I want to suggest to begin with that I want to talk a little bit about the source, sort of underlying source of the problem. And I want to suggest two phrases that have largely disappeared from the American vocabulary that I think we need to get back into the vocabulary. And the first phrase is save up. You ever hear anybody saying, I'm saving up for something? I'm going to work and save up before I buy a car or buy a house or buy a snow machine. That language has sort of disappeared. We don't save it up. We just use our plastic one way or another. And the other thing, and this is related to the problem, is the whole notion of 20% down. 20% down, we've lost that. It used to be for most of the last century or so that if you wanted to buy a piece of real estate, you wanted to buy a house, if you wanted to buy a car, if you wanted to buy a motorcycle, you had to save up and have at least 20% down before you bought it. But the America that we live in today, we've pretty much lost that vocabulary. And what this is, the way this has played out, is we've had a declining rate. I'm going to suggest fundamental to the crisis is a substantial decline in American savings. A decline that started really in the 80s, but persisted sort of steadily into the 90s and got most extreme after 2004, such that in the last 4 years, personal savings, that is how much Americans save out of their take-home check, is now less than 1%. We as Americans on average save less than 1% of our take-home pay and put it in our savings. By contrast, Chinese people save over 30% of their take-home pay. It's no wonder we're borrowing all this money from those folks in China. Now, that decline in savings rates has been driven in part by the miraculous invention of the home equity loan. In fact, your tuition at Whitworth, at least some of you here this year, may well be paid by your parents' home equity loan. And this is this system that, well, you own a home, and your home must have gone up in value, so come into the bank or go online to eLoan, and we'll give you tens and tens and tens of thousands of dollars, and we'll secure it with the value of your home, the equity of which, the value of which must have gone up. So we've had this big explosion of home equity loans. With our home equity loans, sometimes we send our kids to college, but sometimes we also take a vacation in Hawaii or buy that snow machine or buy other consumption things that we want. So we've had this radical decline in personal savings down to less than 1% of income. Simultaneously, since 2001, we went from a federal government budget surplus in 2000 of about $250 billion a year. We have gone since 2001 into federal government budget deficits, such that by the time we get to this fiscal year, the fiscal year ending at the end of next week, that we have a $400 billion deficit. That means the federal government is borrowing a lot of money, and nobody's saving. The federal government isn't saving, and personally, we aren't saving. There's a little corporate savings. Now, the way this was supposed to work in the markets, if free markets are working right, is when savings shrinks and not very many people are savings and lots of people are borrowing, the federal government is borrowing, individuals and companies are borrowing, there should be a shortage of funds and interest rates should rise. And so what we should have expected or would have expected or should have seen would be a sharp rise in interest rates beginning in about 2004. As the government borrowed more and as American people saved less, we should have seen a sharp rise in interest rates because there shouldn't have been enough savings around. And with the rise in interest rates, we should have seen a decline in demand for housing. As interest rates rose and less money was available for new housing, we should have seen a decline in the demand for housing. But whoops, didn't happen that way. What we've seen is an explosive increase in the demand for housing. Why? Where'd the money come from? Basically two sources. The U.S. Federal Reserve, our central bank, has been so concerned about the short-run health of the economy, we dare not have a slight, tiny little recession or even a hint of a recession, so the Fed has pumped new liquidity, new money into the system. Simultaneously, with the advent of new kinds of institutions, like international investment banks, which incidentally, as of this week, don't exist anymore, existed for a while, creative institutions have found ways to package all this mortgage borrowing and sell those packages, that is, borrow the money largely from abroad, much of it from China. So the supply of savings from China and elsewhere abroad and the supply from the Fed has encouraged demand in the housing market to grow. As a consequence, builders made money, people said, hey, you can't lose in housing. So they bought a house today, and they flipped it a month later. We had this big increase in demand, and we have gone on a binge of building what I sort of, to me, seems like 3,000 square foot houses with three bathrooms and three car garages for an average family size in America of 2.8 people. And in case you don't know, nobody else in the world has its middle class people with three car garages. So we built all these houses, this huge number of houses, and we built a lot of vacation houses. And incidentally, I read this week we built 3,500 new golf courses in the last 10 years. And by the way, there are fewer people who golf in 2008 than there were in 2000. Now figure that out. If you're an investor in a golf course, you better get a little bit worried. So we've had this massive overbuilding, and finally in August of last year, August of 2007, as all bubbles happened, the bubble began to burst. California and Florida real estate prices began to drop. And now all these imaginative mortgages where people borrowed 100% of the value of their house, or in some cases the banks lent them 125% of the value, thinking that the prices would go up and they could pay back. Prices began to collapse, rumors spread, speculation stopped, prices have declined substantially. Overall in America, about 10% in the last 12 months, but in key markets like in Florida and California, prices have dropped in some places by 20 or 30 or 40%. Now people can't afford to pay those mortgages, and they're defaulting on them, and our banking system is threatened. Will the $700 billion $700 billion bailout work? Well, my view is these two problems. In a sense, the second, the overbuilding of the housing industry, the bailout won't do anything to solve that problem. We have too many houses out there. We need to wait, let the population grow, have the prices of housing come down, and within a period of probably 18 to 36 months, those houses will be absorbed on the market, and contractors in 18 to 36 months will start working again. And a bailout of $700 billion is not going to solve that problem. Will the long-term aversion of Americans to saving be solved by that, by borrowing another $700 billion? It doesn't seem so to me. It seems like that's the opposite direction to go. I don't think it will solve either of those long-term problems. Okay, let me stop. Thank you.
Okay. Well, welcome. I'm Doug Lahr. Looking at this housing crisis and the financial crisis caused by housing prices, as Dr. Schatz did talk about, Wall Street and our markets, as the Wall Street Journal did say, it's the worst crisis since the 1930s. So obviously there's a lot of interest in this. I have a slightly different take on from Dr. Schatz with the same causes, though. I do believe that, how did we get here? I believe it's from the increased demand in housing also, fueled by subprime mortgages, it's starting in 2000, and the easy Fed dollars that Dr. Schatz did talk about. The subprime mortgages really came about as, well, we should define subprime mortgages. A subprime mortgage is a mortgage that is demanded by someone with credit that is not ideal. And in our financial system, if you're a greater risk to a mortgage originator in this case, you normally pay a higher return or a higher interest rate. So mortgage originators who originate primary loans, be it mortgage banks, credit unions, and other institutions that originate these loans, they did not have a market, and they were taking the risk of these subprimes. But what happened in early 2000 is our president and our administration, with Congress encouraged home ownership, and Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, two organizations that are government-sponsored entities, ended up buying these mortgages from the originators. They repackaged them into something called CDOs, collateralized debt obligations, okay, and mortgage-backed securities, and they sold them on the secondary market. And they sold those to investors, be it investment banks, pension funds, okay, including Washington State and others, okay, and other investors that were trying to receive a yield on these particular mortgage-backed securities. And the way that happens is, as the loans are paid, the cash flow from that goes to the investor. Okay? So as this happened, home ownership went in 1994 to 64% of families to 69% by 2004. So you had more mortgages, and obviously the demand for houses went up, and that caused the prices of homes to go up. Matter of fact, homes went up between 1997 and 2006 by 124% nationwide. So as this happened, folks were refinanced their mortgages as interest rates came down, and as Dr. Schatz talked about, were taking the equity out of their homes. The equity in a home is what the home is worth on the open market minus the balance of a mortgage, and in some cases were allowed to take 125% of equity, where not only the equity up to what the price of the house was on the market, but 25% over that. And they were using that to fuel purchases of other products and services. Now, that's good. It was good for our economy, but you do understand that it was putting the houses at risk as housing prices came down. And why did housing prices start to plunge? And they did in 2007. The largest decline in housing prices in 2007, from 1989, I should say, it was in 2007, the steepest decline. So what happened, as prices went down and defaults on mortgages happened mostly by these subprime borrowers, that added to the ever-increasing inventory of homes. So housing prices continued to go and fall farther. Okay? And at that point, mortgage-backed securities, so the subprime mortgages were no longer in demand by the Freddie Macs and the Fannie Mae's, the buyers of the primary mortgages. So you had, again, that led to even less demand for houses and, again, put downward pressure on housing prices. And as this happened, banks increased their lending standards, so even tougher for someone with good credit, with a good FICO score, to qualify for a loan, and that, again, left more unsold homes, again, putting downward pressure on prices. So eventually, this led to the growing losses of these government-sponsored entities, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, and they eventually had to be bailed out by our U.S. government. Okay? And also, with the easy Fed money, that did not add, that added to the problem. The Fed funds rate, which banks charge each other for overnight loans, went from 6.5% in May of 2000 down to 1.75% in December of 2001. And then Alan Greenspan in 2003, the chairman of our Federal Reserve, lowered it down to 1%, the lowest rate in 45 years. So obviously, especially in the United States, when you have lower interest rates, you are more likely to go to the bank and demand a loan. In the United States, when you receive proceeds from a loan, you spend it. So it leads to the credit problem that we have that Dr. Schatz alluded to. We have too much debt in this country, and we have a culture of immediate gratification. Just to give you the last stat that I saw in the second quarter of this year, we have $2.5 trillion in consumer debt in the United States. Add another $12 trillion in home mortgage debt, and you have a huge amount of debt outstanding. Consumer debt increased by 8.6% year over year. We're using more plastic, as Dr. Schatz alluded to. And 2.5 million people now are in default with their credit cards. When we're talking about default, we're talking about 3 months behind or more. Okay? So also, with what does this mean for you as a student? What does this mean for you as a future employee? What does it mean for employers? People are going to start small businesses. Ben Bernanke characterized the present chairman of the Federal Reserve, characterized the $700 billion bailout or recapitalization plan, depending on what type of spin you want to put on it. Okay? He called it necessary, and so did Hank Paulson, the Treasury Secretary. What they said is it's a credit freeze. And what did they mean by that? Banks are not lending to banks. Evidenced by the LIBOR, which is a London interbank. It's a rate that banks charge internationally for overnight loans. Okay, that spiked last week. That went up. And evidenced, and because of that, banks are not lending to banks. Our Fed funds rate, which is a target of 2% right now, also went up last week of what banks are actually charging each other. So banks won't lend to banks. Banks also will not lend to businesses. The tightening credit standards have led businesses to be denied loans, even good businesses with good credit. What does that mean for you? Okay. Small businesses, especially, where most of our job growth comes in this country, are going to have to shut down if they cannot have access to credit. Businesses that are larger businesses that can't receive expansion loans, they're going to continue to lay people off, increasing unemployment. And as unemployment increases, there's less people, there's less national income to buy goods and services. And as the sales of those go down, those companies start laying people off, thus increasing unemployment also. So you have a cascading effect. And eventually, as Ben Bernanke characterized it, he said we go into a deep recession. Okay? So less use of credit. And we are a credit-dependent society, leading to a possibility of a recession. Mortgage loans, on top of that, the declining in housing prices, the increasing inventory, the unemployment that's related to construction jobs just adds to that problem. And also, as far as your student loans, if the credit markets do freeze, okay, where loans are not being made, that could affect your student loans. Okay? Not to say that has happened yet, but Bernanke is stating that that is a possibility of, as loans are not going to happen. And, of course, Woodworth University long-term, short-term and long-term, how might that affect their enrollment?
There are microphones in the aisles on either side if you want to tee up to pose a question to one of us or make an observation. Please feel free to do so while you're formulating that stump your professor in public question. I thought I would ask Rich something. You know, I don't fundamentally disagree with you that it's indicative of our addiction to debt at a personal, a corporate, and a federal and state government level that has led us into this. And I suspect you're right that it's not enough to get a blank check for $700 billion to buy these bad assets and take them off the banks or other financial institutions' books. so that they can get that capital, so that they'll keep loaning money, so that people can pay their tuition and buy their textbooks and order pizza and all the things that need to happen to keep the economy going. But if we agree that it's unlikely to be the right ultimate medicine and that we do need to reduce our reliance on debt, what would you think would happen, and what would your view of that consequence be if we just said, ride it out?
Well, good question. I am persuaded that there's a high likelihood that we're headed into a deep recession, a serious recession, whether or not we do the bailout. If you look at, you know, most of you students have studied macroeconomics. If you look at the elements of aggregate demand, C plus I plus G plus net exports, consumption is definitely going to go down with or without the bailout, and it's already going down because people are scared to buy now. I'm sure if we could find out from Wendell Ford how many Fords they sold this week up here at the Y, I don't think they'd tell us. But if they tell us, I'd bet tomorrow's lunch that it's far fewer than they sold in a month or two ago in any 1 week. People are cautious now. They've lost confidence. So we're going to get a decline in consumption. Secondly, home equity loan, this easy money loans in order to pay for consumption things have already disappeared. So we're at least on those two counts alone, plus the construction industry is in a nosedive. If you're a carpenter or a sheetrocker, you better buy a chainsaw and head for the National Forest, start cutting firewood because you're not going to have work. So we're going to get consumption going down. Investment in terms of business buying, capital equipment and new buildings, businesses can't get credit, and even if they could, they're going to be cautious. Government spending, we're already facing a $500 billion deficit without the $700 billion borrowed. So there isn't, both McCain and Obama have said all their promises of new programs, they're not going to be able to do those. The world economy is also suffering, so I don't think we're going to export more. So I think we're headed for a recession. But I think we have to be very, very careful that we don't, in a sense, what we did after the attack on the World Trade Center, the 9/11 attack. In a sense, we panicked, and we looked for somebody to attack, and so we went and attacked Iraq, a war that cost us, so far, $500 billion, less than the bailout. We have to be careful in the panic of the last 10 days over these Wall Street firms that are may or may not go bankrupt, that we make a decision in the sort of urgency of the panic that doesn't address our long-run problems but costs us a huge amount of money. So I'm not at all convinced that I think we're going to have a recession, and we can't avoid it. And I'm not convinced that spending another $700 billion, $2,300 for each of us, $2,300 for every American on this one deal that they want to pass by Friday is really, I'm not persuaded that it solves anything. I'm also persuaded that the Fed has the powers and the resources that if your bank account, if you go to Bank of America tomorrow morning and try to take your money out, that if the Bank of America by 10 tomorrow morning has 500 people lined up at your branch, the Fed has the capacity to address that problem now. The first thing they'd probably do is they'd close the banks. They'd order all banks closed. And then the Fed has the power, those little green sheets of paper in your pocket, the Fed can print those things. So I'm persuaded that if the banking system, if there's a run on banks, that the Fed has the power already to address that run. And I don't see how the $700 billion gets us very far. But I'm uncertain on this also. Thanks, Philip.
That was my next question. Are you sure enough about that very, you know, persuasive sounding analysis, not just to bet, you know, somebody's house, but to bet the country and maybe the global economy?
And I would follow that up with, I'm not one that likes to see regulation of business or over-regulation of business. But I believe,
The other day telling me you were a little concerned that Ron Paul's a little bit too far left.
Yeah, exactly. I do believe, though, that there are times in our history that we need this type of help from our government. And it's happened very rarely, but I believe for confidence purposes, for investor confidence and consumer confidence, that this bailout, or let's call it a recapitalization plan, is needed. And it is yet to be determined exactly how that plan is going to work, but I believe that it's not going to cost the taxpayer $700 billion. Now, what they're buying assets. So what's going to happen is they're going to have a reverse auction, and they're going to allow companies with distressed assets, those mortgage-backed securities, to actually bid or actually submit a bid to the U.S. government and call it the Recapitalization Fund or the Resolution Trust II Fund or whatever you want to call it. And the lowest bid then the government will buy those assets, take them off the books of these investment banks and other organizations that have these distressed mortgage-backed assets. And what they will do is they will either resell them or they will hold them to maturity, and there will be value either through the cash flow as they hold them to maturity, and that will be recouped by our U.S. government, okay? So that will go get to $700 billion. Or they will sell them, turn around and sell them to other organizations who are going to buy them as the markets do start to recover. And it's a security now, just like any other investment. And that money will go towards that $700 billion price tag. And I believe that there's already, with this plan in place or about to be in place, you see some investors like Warren Buffett actually injected $5 billion into Goldman Sachs with the confidence that this plan will be in place, there'll be more stability, and this will start to, I think that this will start to have other private equity or other investors start to invest in these organizations because of the increased consumer/investor confidence.
All right. So if I'm persuaded, mm-hmm. I listened to Rich and I was with him. Now that sounds good. So I'm with you now. And if I agree, I need you're going to get my vote for intervention. Mm-hmm. I'm going to give Secretary Paulson.
It pains me to say to admit that I'm for intervention. But yes.
Yeah, I knew that was difficult for you. But all right. But here, help me get comfortable with this. Investment banks that designed these collateralized debt obligations, the CDOs that were sold by Fannie Mae and that AIG wrote the credit default swaps for, and all these complicated financial engineering that the people you train go and do and make big fat salaries for. I admire Hank Paulson's public service, but he can afford it. Because he's got, he had before Goldman Sachs went down.
He's former CEO of Goldman Sachs.
30-something years in the investment banking industry, so, he knows what he's talking about. He also, did pretty well for himself, over $500 million in assets before he became Treasury Secretary. Right. And in 1 year, got a $38 million bonus on top of his $1 million pittance of a salary. Mm-hmm. And there's a whole bunch of people like that. Mm-hmm. And I know when I drive around Spokane, not everybody is as fortunate as the people that come to Whitworth. There's a lot of blue-collar people in this town, many of whom didn't get a lot of formal education, but they do an honest day's work for an honest day's pay. They pay their taxes. They didn't do what Schott said and always go overextend with their credit card and buy more house than they could because somebody would give them a liar loan where they just had to make up some number about how much income they had. Is this bailout, which you reluctantly deemed necessary, not a transfer of wealth from that person to those people that are making the fat checks already?
Well, a couple things. I do agree with Dr. Schatz. I believe we're going to be in a recession no matter what happens. We might be already as we backdate that. But I believe, and I do tend to agree with Ben Bernanke, that if we don't, I don't believe we will be able to unfreeze the credit markets. I don't think banks will willingly lend to banks, banks to businesses, banks to individuals. And that will lead to an even deeper recession than it might have been. And as far as the protections, I think what you're alluding to, Dr. Hutchins, is the protections of Main Street, of us hardworking folks. And the part of that plan would have to have something in it to protect those folks. And part of that is the debate of executive compensation, and should executives of a firm that is so-called bailed out, should they receive some type of increased compensation or a golden parachute, per se, as they might leave. So that's certainly being debated in Congress as part of that bill. The other things that are being debated is an oversight committee. You cannot give $700 billion to anyone as a blank check, so to have perhaps a three-person bipartisan committee to actually administer this particular $700 billion, and it wouldn't be at one time. It would be in something called tranches, which is our installments, and that would be over a certain period. And much like an investment banker gives installments to a small business as they invest in them, this particular fund would have, led by Paulson and Bernanke, they would have to perform at a level that is deemed necessary or deemed in a positive way, where they could actually receive another installment. So I believe there's some safeguards in place to protect the common folk.
But Doug, I really don't disagree with you. I don't know for sure whether we need it, but I find an enormous irony as I look at the way our federal government has operated in the last few years. I believe it was last fall, less than a year ago, legislation went from the Congress to the President to extend medical care to 12 million uninsured American children. That legislation was vetoed by President Bush on the grounds that we can't afford it. If I remember the numbers correctly, it was about $25 billion over 4 years, so $6 or $7 billion a year. We can't afford it. Those children are just not important enough. It's not critical enough to get them medical care. But now when we have Wall Street in trouble, Paulson himself, according to what I read today, has a $700 million fortune accumulated as a result of his participating right in the middle of the kind of banking that led to the crisis. But we can quickly afford to write a check for $700 billion, but there's no crisis for the 12 million children without medical care. Now, there's just something that really gnaws at me about that says, I'd rather personally, let's wait at least a few weeks and see how many firms go bankrupt and see if the system is on the verge of freezing up, and let's deal with it then. But you didn't have, I don't mean you, but the government didn't have any hesitation to turn down medical care for poor children. So my heart is not real big for those Wall Street bankers.
Thank you.